Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, there are more of you than I suspected there might be. Excellent. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Sandy Ingham, your consulting minister. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome you, no matter your ethnic or religious background, no matter where you are on this journey, whether you call it a spiritual journey, the journey of life, we welcome you, whatever your color, sexual orientation, ethnic and religious background, gender, family structure, your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Later on in the service, we'll have you will be invited to tell us who you are, if you're visiting, or if this is one of your first times. As always, I encourage you to come to more than one service because our services are all different. Sometimes I do them, sometimes someone from within the congregation does them, sometimes an outside speaker will do a service. The opening words, titled A Great Need, written by someone called Haviz, somewhere around 1325 to 1389. Out of a great need, we are all holding hands and climbing. Not loving is a letting go. Listen, this terrain around here is far too dangerous for that. We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace. This reading is from Finding Beauty in a Broken World by Terry Tempest Williams. They hear the sound of a truck coming toward their town, the slamming of doors, the voices, the pressure of feet walking toward them. From inside their burrows, they see the well-worn sole of a boot, now the pointed toe of the boot, kicking out the entrance to their burrow. Blue Levi's bending down, gloved hands flicking a lighter, the flame, the heat, then the hands shoving something burning inside the entrance. Something is burning. They back up further down their tunnel, smoke now curling inside the darkness as the boot is kicking dirt inside, closing their burrow, covering their burrow, tamping the entrance shut. They are scurrying down, 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 around. They cannot see. What they smell is fear. They cough and wheeze. Their eyes are burning. Their lungs are tightening. They cannot breathe. They try to run, turn, nowhere to turn. Every one of them trying to escape, to flee. But all exits and entrances of their burrows have been kicked closed. The toxic smoke is chasing them like a snake. An invisible snake herding them toward an agonizing death of suffocation, strangulation, every organ in spasm until they collapse onto each other's bodies, noses covered in blankets of familiar fur, families, young and old, slowly, cruelly gassed to death. The truck drives away. The American flag is flapping in the wind, the red, white, and blue banner of the American West that says the right of private property, the rights of private property take precedence over the lives of prairie dogs who are standing in the way of development. In this case, development of golf courses in Cedar City, Utah, very near where I was when I was at Zion National Park a couple of weeks ago. Prairie dogs. They know how to create and maintain civil society. In this reading, humans destroying the community of prairie dogs were acting out of an uncivil society. You could ask, who cares about prairie dogs? You could ask that, but not caring is a mistake. I will return to that in a few minutes. Memorial Day always brings up memories of my father, who was a World War II veteran. He landed in Normandy on D-Day, battled through the hedgerows and the attacks by the German soldiers to get to the town of Saint-Lô. If you go to Normandy today and want to go to Saint-Lô, or the other way around, it will take you about 45 minutes by car. It took the Allied troops about 45 days to go there in June and July of 1944. My dad was shot in the arm as the Allied troops made their laborious way south of Saint-Lô. That wound was not life-threatening, but required his going back to England for treatment and to heal, and penicillin was not easily obtainable. My father lost a leg in the Battle of the Bulge. That wound was considerably more traumatic and required a long, long recovery. In fact, you might say never recovered from that. I did the eulogy at his memorial service in 2008. In it, I talked about what it was like for these veterans, 50 and 60 years later, to watch how the world changed in the decades after the war ended. My dad and other World War II veterans would often express strong opinions about the state of the world in general, the United States in particular, and as you might expect, they were dismayed by some changes, puzzled by others, and heartened by some. The men that I knew personally, and I went to France with my dad three times for D-Day anniversaries, so I got to know some of them, but the ones I knew personally and from anecdotes thought that they had made a huge contribution to keeping the world safe for democracy. They are and were proud of this, rightfully so, I think. Democracy for them meant building and sustaining a civil society. They made a promise to, a covenant with, this country to preserve our freedom. Now, I doubt that they gave much thought to the ideals they were fighting for when they were in the midst of the battles, and they were so young then. But as they aged and matured, they gave more thought to why civil societies matter. What I don't doubt is their commitment to civil society. They did not give up their lives, their arms, their legs. They did not witness their buddies being blown up in front of them, as my dad did, so that we could have what we now have, an uncivil society. I should just say that when I use the word covenant, which is from French and Middle English word convenir, it just simply means what you probably are thinking, I hope, to agree. We think of it often as being solemn, formal, binding agreement, but it's a promise. It's entering into agreement, a contract, a pledge. Lifelong staunch Republican that my father was, I am as certain as I can be that he would not tolerate what is happening in this election year. He would not understand it, but then who does? It would be inconceivable to him and the other veterans I knew that compromise is a dirty word. He would be appalled that members of our United States Congress, an institution that he fought and came close to dying for, that those representatives and senators have given up working with the people on the other side of the aisle. What did our veterans fight for? For the rights of the individual or for strong community or both? To achieve a truly civil society, Won't we have to find a balance between rugged individualism and communal living, or communal being in society? Individualism versus communalism. When I first typed in communalism, of course, the computer told me that wasn't a word. But it is a word. It's in the dictionary. Must be a word. When I use it, I mean it in the best sense of the word. I mean group solidarity to balance out that rugged individualism that this country has gone too far that way. And Unitarian Universalists are probably more guilty than anybody else in that. So I'm not using communalism meaning, as the dictionary put it, loyalty to a socio-political grouping based on religious or ethnic affiliation. I'm not using it that way. Closely connected to this whole individual versus community conundrum is this society's insistence on defining life in terms of winning or losing. There always has to be a winner, and of course, if there's a winner, then there is a loser. I also should say, excuse me, that having this discussion about what constitutes a civil society is something that I believe can't happen unless people are reasonably well-fed, have adequate housing, and ideally employment. In less affluent societies, this conversation wouldn't be happening. For most, we are very privileged people, of course. For most of us, our first experience of building a civil society happens in our families of origin. And if you are a first-born child, you may have struggled with civility in much the same way our protagonist, Elmore Green, did in the story For All Ages. You had your territory staked out. You had the undivided attention of your parents or caregivers, and then this other being enters your world and completely upsets it. You had to discover, sometimes painfully, what living in community means. How many of you have ever lived in a dormitory? Well, I just lived in one 2 weeks ago. Not something I really wanted to return to, but the least expensive and easiest way for me to stay at the bottom of the Grand Canyon for a week is in the dorm. And of course, the clientele in the dorm changes almost nightly. It's very unusual to be able to be down there for six nights, as I was. In fact, supposedly you can't do that, but I have friends. So anyway, I'm not sure it's entirely possible to maintain a civil society in this setting. There's always at least one person who does not seem to grasp the concept of sharing, of taking turns, of being aware of other beings. And I'm not talking about teenagers here. I'm talking about people my age and not too young. I think a covenant would have been useful a couple weeks ago. One of the chapters in Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, is titled, How Should We Speak to One Another? It is also the eighth step in her 12-step program. I find myself returning to this intriguing, compact book again and again since its publication in 2010, and you know I've mentioned it before. Karen Armstrong, whom I've also talked about before, is one of the leading theologians of our times. She's a closet Unitarian Universalist. She has admitted that. She grew up Roman Catholic and was a nun for a while. I've also mentioned the website associated with the book. The website is charterforcompassion.org, which I hope you will take time to visit if you haven't already. And I continue also to hope that we, as Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, will consider signing that charter for compassion. How should we speak to one another? Well, not the way we have been over the past several years. But here's another caveat. There has been incivility in this country since its founding, of course. Political brawls, name-calling. I don't think it's been as bad as it is now, but it might help us remember that we have a history of incivility. In 1800, an election year, a newspaper from that time said that murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes if Thomas Jefferson won the presidency. Which of course he did. And this from the 1828 campaign. Andrew Jackson, general, war hero, was accused of being a cannibal. A pamphlet that was being passed around at that time said, "The bloodthirsty Jackson began again to show his cannibal propensities." I don't know what this was based on, but he too, of course, won. Yeah, maybe we haven't come too far. Armstrong gives us two words to guide us in our conversations with others: dialogue and compassion, to which I would add the word covenant. And she's talking about real dialogue. She reminds us that for Socrates and Plato, a dialogue was a spiritual exercise designed to produce a profound psychological change in the participants. The purpose was that each person should understand the depth of his, we would now add, or her, each person should understand the depth of his or her ignorance. There was no way then that anybody could win. That wasn't even part of a concept for Plato and Socrates. Plato said that dialogue is communal meditation. Hard work, he said. It requires a great expense of time and trouble. And that's a quote, supposedly, from Plato. Well, if dialogue required a great expense of time and trouble in his day, how much more difficult is it in our day? In addition, Plato was adamant that dialogue be, I love this phrase, conducted in a kindly, compassionate manner. Again, supposedly a quote. It was crucial that questions and answers be exchanged in good faith and without malice. But here's my favorite instruction from Plato on what to do when engaged in dialogue. Each person must make a place for the other in his or her mind, and allowing them to unsettle his or her own convictions. And of course, then when the roles of listener and speaker are reversed, the same instructions apply. Each person must make a place for the other in his or her mind. Socrates, Plato, the Buddha, Jesus, all believe that while we have the truths that we need to build a civil society, we have these truths within ourselves. It is compassionate dialogue that will help us in the process of self-discovery to draw out these truths. Once upon a time, the Buddha helped a tribe of people known as the Kalamans. They were overwhelmed by a new urban civilization bearing down on their tribe, new people coming into their community, new ways of doing things. Maybe they felt a little like poor Elmore Green did, trying to adjust to a new way of being when his little brother appeared. The Kalaman tribe had invited several religious teachers to visit them and try to help them sort through this, try to help them adjust. But as they told the Buddha, when they eventually got around to inviting him to talk to them, these so-called teachers only made them more confused, because each teacher was intent only on winning, that is, in having his philosophy or doctrine or beliefs adopted by the Kalamans. Each teacher put down, denigrated the other teachers and their beliefs. But as the Buddha told the Kalamans, well, you already know the answers to this dilemma. You know how to live in changing times. The answers are within you. The Buddha's task was to draw the solution out by asking such questions as, is greed good or bad? What happens to a person consumed by greed or by hate? Karen Armstrong has done considerable work in the area of interfaith dialogue and cooperation, especially since 9/11. She believes that we can understand terrorists, not condone or excuse what they do, but we can understand the reasons for their actions. She gives this example of how to understand that which is alien or incomprehensible to us. She describes how Jewish scholars living in the time period of, about 30 years before the birth of Jesus and up to about 45 years after, so roughly during the time period Jesus lived, how these scholars who were trained in Greek philosophy approached the Torah, which even to them, those many years ago, was ancient text. They didn't dismiss the text because they were or seemed to be barbaric. Rather, they were able to interpret them in a way that fit with the then current times. Well, how'd they do that? Why didn't they just give up on the ancient text? Because the Jewish scholars made what Armstrong calls a charitable assumption. And that charitable assumption was that those ancient Hebrew texts, however strange they seem to the Jews trying to interpret them hundreds of years later, the scholars made the charitable assumption that the authors of the texts were human beings, just like them, with human needs and wants, desires and frustrations, joys and concerns. To understand others, whether those who lived long, long ago, or those who are our contemporaries but seem complete mysteries to us, we have to make that charitable assumption, and we have to try to understand where people are coming from, or were coming from in this example. And there's one more important element of dialogue. We have to meet people where they are, not where they want, what, where we want them to be, or where we wish they were. Donald Davidson, who was a professor of philosophy at the University of California in Berkeley, said, "Making sense of the utterances and behaviors of others, even their most aberrant behavior, requires us to find a great deal of truth and reason in them. Charity is forced on us, whether we like it or not. If we want to understand others," Davidson concludes, "we must count them right in most matters." Count them right in most matters. Now imagine trying to apply that kind of charity to a dialogue with an aspiring terrorist. Yet that is what Armstrong and many others would have us do. And they make excellent arguments for responding to injustice without hatred and contempt. Gandhi often asked people engaged in social justice work to think about whether they were fighting to change things or to punish. We can learn to be firm in our convictions without falling into self-righteousness or the same kind of intolerance that we are arguing against. We can learn to express our deeply held beliefs without letting our ego get better and, I mean, bigger, bigger, not better, bigger and bigger. If only politicians, well, never mind. Speaking of egos, right? If you were raised in the Christian tradition, you know that a good dialogue, a true dialogue, has to be based on love. You might remember Paul's, one of his letters to the Corinthians about love is not proud, love is egoless, ideally. Love does not hurt others, love is not rude. That word love is often translated as charity. There's another way to define covenant. Unitarian Universalist and Methodist minister Rebecca Parker says that at its simplest, covenant means to come together. More precisely, it means to come together by making a promise to love and care for one another. Unitarian Universalists, Parker says, often speak of covenant as a verbal statement of promise between individuals who, exercising their freedom of choice, bring community into being. There's that balance. Individuals who bring community into being. I hope that's what we attempt to do here. I think we succeed most of the time. This brings me back to what I was saying at the beginning of my remarks about that balance between rugged individualism and community or communalism. To achieve a truly civil society, I think we have to find that balance. And I believe we are very out of balance in this country. We have to get beyond rugged individualism, not only for the sake of humanity, but also for the sake of the rest of creation. We have to figure out how to get closer to following the ideals. I'm going to blow this pronunciation here. The ideals of the Haudenosaunee. Anybody know that? AKA the Iroquois. The Haudenosaunee people. I grew up in Iroquois, Haudenosaunee territory. They try, this part will be familiar, I think, to many of you. They try to live in a way that would ensure not only their children's future, but the futures of seven generations out from their own. I'm waiting to hear some dialogue about this concept in the presidential campaign. Once we can accept that community is as important, if not more so, than individualism, then the next step is to include all creatures and all of Mother Earth in our civil society. The prairie dogs matter. A few pages after the reading that I used earlier from Terry Tempest Williams' book is a page that has only two words on it in the form of a question, which is, whose society? Whose society? Who cares about the prairie dogs and civil society? Well, Terry Tempest Williams does. In 2003, a few weeks before we invaded Iraq, she wrote this in an opinion piece in the New York Times. Quite simply, the story of the prairie dog is the story of the range of our compassion. If we can extend our idea of community to include the lowliest of creatures, call them the untouchables, then we will indeed be closer to a path of peace and tolerance. If we cannot accommodate the other, which she puts in quotes, the shadow we will see on our own home ground will be the forecast of our own species' extended winter of the soul. So she wrote that in 2003. When was 9/11? 2001. So the extended winter of the soul was in some ways perhaps already here. Who cares about these untouchables, these species who cannot speak for themselves? Jane Goodall does. She said, only if we understand can we care. Only if we care can we help. Only if we help shall they be saved. And to that I would add, will we be saved? Who cares about creating a civil society? Karen Armstrong, who tirelessly, or so it seems, especially if you've ever tried to keep up with her writing and her publications, tirelessly works for interfaith understanding through dialogue and compassion. She cares. Who cares about creating a civil society within and throughout our political system? Well, the National Institute for Civil Discourse does. Ever heard of it? Andy's nodding his head. The National Institute for Civil Discourse. Visit its website. It's a fascinating organization formed in May of 2011 in response to the shooting in January of that year in Tucson, Arizona, of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and several others. 6 people killed, 13 wounded. NCID is a nonpartisan organization that works to promote healthy and civil political debate. Does that not just do your heart good? Healthy and civil political debate. Wow, what a concept. NCID believes that people can have very different values and political preferences, but can still discuss these differences in a civil manner. Ooh. Here are the NICD's current research goals. 1, what is the nature and what are the causes and consequences of incivility? 2, what are the leverage points for doing something about political dysfunction? 3, what are the things that can be done to change the current political dysfunction? Carol Lukensmeyer, who is executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, recently wrote a column titled Reviving Civility. She writes, "It is easy to understand why some Americans aren't using their words." I love the analogy to little kids. Use your words, use your words. They think they aren't being heard. The solution is not to hunker down, talking only to those who agree with us. And then she says, incivility stems from fear of an idea, of a person, that they might actually have a point. Examples of how to move towards a truly civil society are all around us. The National Institute for Civil Discourse, the restorative justice programs, journalists like Paul Krugman of the New York Times, who consistently calls us out, us Americans, for our lack of policy for how we treat the youngest members of our society. In mid-May, Krugman wrote, "America is unique among advanced countries in its utter indifference to the lives of its youngest citizens." In other words, we neglect the lives of our children who can't speak for themselves, like the prairie dogs. I'm not comparing our children with prairie dogs, but except for the inability to speak for themselves. Taking care of the most vulnerable among us, who can argue with this policy? Yet we do argue about this because we are currently living in an uncivil society. If we were living in a civil society, well, I'll use the words of Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editor David Haynes here. In a confident America, which he doesn't think we have at the moment, but in a confident America, we have a basic faith in one another. We question each other's ideas vigorously, but we don't question each other's motives. Despite all the reasons to be pessimistic and gloomy about what is happening in our culture and our society right now, there are just as many reasons, if not more, to be optimistic and to continue to work towards civility. And to remember the question Stephen Hawking asked, what makes humans unique? And he answered his own question this way, transcending limits. We limit ourselves with hate, war, jealousy, fear, any number of things, all of which lead to uncivil societies. But we are always capable of transcending these limits. Dialogue, compassion, covenant, good foundations for building a civil society. I think that, this obviously I get interested in and excited about this kind of thing. And I've always been socially justice active, I hope. But it seems to me the next step for us, as you use, but maybe for liberals in general, is to figure out how to, first of all, where are we going to find the people to dialogue with? Are we going to, go to the next protest? But we need the protest that wouldn't be our protest. Yeah, yeah. Because we need to, maybe we could even do some role playing here in this, among ourselves. And I'm reminded a little bit of what Faith did that Sunday with the Black Lives Matter, only that wasn't the title of it, but that just talking to people who happen to look differently, but what about talking to people who think differently? How do we do that? I think that's the next frontier for Unitarian Universalists. Well, you just triggered two memories of mine. One was on NPR years and years ago. They had a debate between right to life and right to choice to women, and it was fascinating. I think it was one of those. I was driving the car and I had to pull over to really listen, because the point was to try to find common ground. The common ground, as I remember, was. Life, that life is sacred. And they did get to that point. They didn't go much farther, at least not in that program. And then at General Assembly 2 years ago, I didn't go last year, so it had been 2 years ago, a theist and an atheist, both on our board of our UUA Board of Trustees. So this was thrown into the middle of a business meeting, probably because we have to go to business meetings and they want as many people there as possible. And they talked about trying to find common ground there on that religious faith scale. And they did find common ground. And then there are discussions going on among Palestinians and Israelis. So it does happen. I'm feeling better. I think that's true of most UUs.
Yeah.
That, or most people who are unchurched or somewhere else on the spectrum, we don't want to be that force. And of course, that has led us to never ever say anything about who we are. Okay. Go in peace and with a promise to yourself to practice compassion and civility in our dialogues with each other for the rest of the day and all through the week. And the kids are outside. It's a wonderful sound.